Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 6 of Space Talks. And by now you know it's a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's topic.
Thanks, Steve. Last week our show was all about radio telescopes, land-based telescopes that have played a huge role in astronomy for more than a century. And we're moving things up a bit to consider the latest kids on the block, the James Webb Space Telescope, and then we're going to compare that with the more familiar Hubble telescope. So we previously mentioned that radio telescopes have the ability to look into our past, and while that's true, both the Hubble and Webb telescopes are incredibly more powerful, and they certainly can look back into the past with stunning clarity.
A few years ago, you and I both got excited about the movie starring Sandra Bullock called Gravity. And I'm sure people who saw that science fiction movie recall it starts with astronauts working on repairs to the Hubble telescope. And that's one of the differences with the new Webb. There just won't be any house calls. It's been sent on a 10-year minimum mission with as much onboard redundancy as possible. And we'll explain later today why it's on its own when it comes to warranty work.
You know, Steve, it sure seems risky to me. At launch, this new telescope, the Webb telescope, cost $10 billion. But before we get into all of the differences and merits of this, I believe, Steve, you have an update for us.
Well, it really is an update. I just happened to notice that today NASA had a live spacewalk television relay. The spacewalk took over 5 hours, and it involved two American female astronauts, Jasmine Mobelli and Laurel O'Hara. And they were repairing solar ray panels, allow future modifications to it. And during this, I noticed that they were using a rotary drill to screw in some of the hatch panels. And I was reminded when I saw the rotary drill starting to move of the torque involved. They have to have special drills in space to counterbalance the torque, because if you just hold on to the driver and pull the trigger, the torque, the inside is going to turn to the right and you're holding on to it. And so your whole body will turn with it as well. So there has to be a contra rotating mechanism in the inside to counter that. And I just was reminded of that and thought it was utterly fascinating.
That is interesting. And thanks for that, Steve. So way back in 1990, that's when the Hubble telescope was put into service. And its size, the size of that space vessel, is part of the story, because the telescope had to fit inside the cargo space of the shuttle's cargo bay. And that's how the telescope, of course, reached space with the shuttle. And once again, Canada has been a solid contributor to the project, along with NASA, the European Space Agency, Japan, and a few other countries have chipped in. But I know, Steve, you've looked into the Canadian content here.
I did. And for a little flashback for a second, noting that in our last episode, we also mentioned the significant role Canada played in radio telescopes, including the one you saw while paddling in Algonquin Park. Now let's talk about the Canadian developed sensors that help point Hubble at a given target, keeping in mind dynamic orbital mechanics. And by that, I mean the telescope is orbiting about the Earth, which is itself rotating around the sun, and the sun is rotating around the center of our galaxy. The math required to position Hubble and keep it focused there is obviously complicated. Canadian technology was employed to design the fine guidance sensors, which keep Hubble pointed as precisely as possible at a distant target. This FGS technology is based on a system of laser gyroscopes measuring very small changes in the telescope's orientation and sending signals to adjust its position. And these sensors were designed and built by the Canadian company Dynacon Incorporated, located in Mississauga, Ontario, and under contract to the Canadian Space Agency. And those sensors keep Hubble on target to within 7/1000ths of one arc second deviation over the course of a day. And you know what? I don't know, really know of anybody who can explain that, but maybe Tim, can you give it a shot?
I'm really going to start to glow if you compliment me like that, Steve. And I wish I could pretend to have come up with this explanation, but let's be clear, no one would believe it. So let's say you're looking at the moon, the full moon as an example, and it covers about 0.5 degree of the night sky, which equals about 30 arc minutes or 1800 arc seconds. So the shorthand is you divide 1 degree of transit into 60 minutes, and even more finely, you can divide it into 3600 arc seconds. And as the Hubble tracks across the night sky using those fine guidance sensors to align the telescope, it would only deviate by about 0.03 of a degree over the course of 12 hours, which explains the incredible clarity of the images we've been seeing from Hubble over the last 30 years.
But Tim, right now I'm reminded of that Larson cartoon where the high school student asks to be excused from class because his head is full. Let me try to approach arc minutes and such in a little different manner. You can use your hand to make rough angular measurements in the sky, including measuring those distances in degrees. If you extend your arm fully, make a fist, that fist will cover about 10 degrees of the sky. And this is often referred to as the 10 degree rule. Even simpler, the width of your little finger held at arm's length typically covers 1 or 2 degrees in the sky. Now, with that aside, I know that most Canadians have heard of the Canadarm, which was in service on the space shuttle program, and more recently, its bigger and more complex brother, the Canadarm 2, on the space station. Interestingly, south of the border, you almost never hear this robotic device referred to as the Canadarm, but rather the Remote Manipulator System, or RMS, for, shall we say, obvious political reasons. Canadarm 2 is a key component to the International Space Station and plays a crucial role in assembling, maintaining, and servicing the station. On last week's episode, we mentioned how Canada played a role in mapping the contours of that asteroid Bennu and literally sucked up some of that asteroid's regolith. Now Canada can add to that expertise because of similar technological expertise in the fine guidance sensors, which are also being used on the Webb telescope.
Right, Stephen. And you can see how this scientific work is building on past insights and work in terms of the Canadian contributions. And we can see that these Canadian investments in sensors, but we can also see it in the transition from the Hubble to the Webb. So the Hubble observes our universe using the visible or ultraviolet portions of the electromagnetic spectrum, the shorter wavelengths. By comparison, Webb is primarily focused on the infrared portion of the spectrum, and that, of course, complements the data we've been receiving from the Hubble. But here's a more simple comparison between the two telescopes, and that is where they orbit around our planet. Hubble is a mere 530 kilometers above the Earth, whereas the Webb telescope is 3,000 times further away, a staggering 1.5 million kilometers from us. And of course, that makes those house calls impossible. In fact, back in 1990, assembling, launching, and ensuring a telescope of this size to orbit at that point wouldn't have been possible.
And there are also noticeable differences in size and mass between the two, which we have to mention. Whereas Hubble is about the size of a school bus, Webb is much larger, being about the size of a tennis court. Interestingly, though, while Webb is larger, its mass is only 6,500 kilograms, half that of Hubble's 11,000 kilograms. A more telling contrast is in their respective mirror sizes, with Hubble's at 2.4 meters in diameter and Webb's at 6.5 meters, three times larger.
So once again, bigger is better when it comes to astronomy. We always know that. And now you've got this $10 billion investment in the Webb telescope, and it's 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. That's actually about four times further away than the moon. And of note, there have in fact been five repairs, missions to the Hubble spacecraft, using what is the same technology and trajectories that put astronauts into low Earth orbit. So we can do that, but getting to Webb at its Lagrange point, 1.5 million kilometers away, well, it's kind of out of the question.
And so, Tim, you have to remind us, what are the Lagrange points?
Well, there's five of them. They were, of course, discovered by a scientist named Lagrange a long time ago. And the Webb telescope is going to L2. Now, a Lagrange point is a sun-centric point in space where the gravitational force from the Earth is similar to that of the sun. A satellite boosted to that spot stays in a stable orbit there around both the sun and the Earth. So to service the Webb telescope would require uneconomical amounts of fuel to get there, decelerate to match its speed, then accelerate back to Earth, and then finally decelerate to enter the atmosphere. Not really credible.
And another factor which makes servicing impossible are the challenges of exposing servicing astronauts to ionizing cosmic radiation while on their long journey to and from that Lagrange point. And this leads us to comparing their expected serviceability. Hubble has been operating for over 30 years and is expected to last for another 10. Webb, however, will only have about 10 years or so and will remain healthy only until its onboard systems begin to irreparably fail. Discussing the relative merits of the Hubble and James Webb Space Telescopes, with the latter being a whopping 1.5 million kilometers away, the absolute lack of Earth's atmosphere greatly improves its sensitivity to infrared emissions. Recalling that infrared radiation is heat waves, Webb is shielded by a large sunshade, keeping its temperatures low. And speaking of temperatures, Tim, you've done some research about this. How does that work?
Well, the sunshade is helping the telescope in a couple of ways. It's limiting the amount of radiation and heat that's reaching the telescope, but it's a matter of degrees, I suppose. So on the hot side, facing the sun, it's about 85 degrees C. But on the cold side, which is where they keep the mirrors and the detectors and filters, it's more like minus 233 degrees Celsius, kind of a huge difference. Point out that in comparing the two, because it's at the Lagrange point, the Webb telescope is never in the shadow of either the Earth or the Moon. So it is always 24/7, if you will, always able to point at a target, whereas the Hubble is going in and out of shadow, if you will, every 90 minutes, just like any other orbiting spacecraft circling the Earth. Pretty huge difference. So this is why these house calls can be so difficult, and they don't even plan to try. There have been the missions that have taken repairs to the Hubble, but the L2 point, there is some movement. It isn't exactly static. So there's some movement, and it requires a small amount of boosting the telescope into the right place from time to time, and it makes communications more complicated. And of course, you've got this sun shield orbiting around, which is 69 meters wide. It's just way too much math and complications and risk to rely on NASA sending the proverbial Maytag man out there to do repairs. So it's going to rely on a few other coping strategies to try to keep the thing going and keep it up there as long as possible. There's a lot more redundancy in the systems. Obviously, there's a capacity for software updates. And they already have built in all kinds of contingency strategies and what they're calling operational flexibility.
Once it's at its Lagrange position, it's going to be sort of a go-with-the-flow scenario from that time on, is it?
It is. They're hoping to keep this up and operational for 10 years, and I'm sure deep down they're thinking it's going to last a lot longer than that. So we focused on how these two amazing space telescopes operate, and we've discussed how they observe differently and the size, the technology, and location, and so on. But the fun stuff for me is really about what they're looking for and what's ahead. And I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to jump right ahead to the question that people really want to ask about looking into space is, are we alone? And the Hubble telescope wasn't really intended to answer that question, but good news, the Webb, that's very much the point for this telescope in terms of its technology and the work underway. So the Webb has the ability to study exoplanets, and we've talked about those before, Steve. Those are planets orbiting other stars that have some similarities to our own planet and have some capability of hosting life, as we know it, in terms of their atmosphere, gravity, and so on. It wasn't that long ago that we were excited to find even one or two exoplanets. It would make the news. Well, now there's a veritable catalog of these things, and more are being found with incredible regularity. So the new technology on board the Webb telescope will not only be able to find an exoplanet and determine its chemical composition, but also things like its temperature profile and the presence of certain gases, clouds, or even potential signs of habitability. Steve, I mean, you know, you have to sort of take your breath away at a moment like this to think, how is that actually happening? Here we've got a telescope itself, 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. It's up there now. It has the ability to track down a planet light years from us, examine the composition of that atmosphere, see if there's even clouds there, and make predictions about the weather patterns. And to give this some kind of context, I love doing this, Steve. 100 years or so ago, the Wright brothers were fiddling around with what would become the first flight of an airplane. And it wasn't even that long ago that some of my relatives thought that the moon was made of cheese.
Well, as they say, Tim, don't bury the lead. Is there life elsewhere in the universe? Most likely, but at what stage of intellectual development? Let's not forget that Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, and the earliest form of life has been found along the shores of Hudson Bay dating back to 4.3 billion years. And so the caveat here is that for almost all of that period of life on Earth, it only consisted of single-cell organisms. And if we use a 24-hour clock as a metaphor, if life began 1 second after 12, humans don't exist on the planet until 4 seconds until time's up. So is there life? Is it intelligent? And what might it be? Well, the Webb telescope might just let us know about that too.
I hope so. And a good question is, well, just how, you know, how is it going to do that? So reading up about this telescope, I was kind of struck, Steve, about the simplicity of the basic ideas and then blown away by the fact that it's actually being done. And I'll tell you what I mean. So let's imagine a planet like ours orbiting a star like our sun, but many, many light years away. So that distant planet will, circling its own sun, transit across the face of the host star and then, of course, disappear behind, you know, from our perspective. The science is about detecting the impact of that orbit, that planet passing in front of its host star, and how the light from the host star changes when the planet is getting in the way, creating a shadow. And then if you could eliminate the blaring light of the host star, there would also be the corona of light adjacent to the planet, if you will, going through its own atmosphere. And that would impact the light, the nature of the light, and that's what they're tracking. I mean, it sounds simple enough in theory, but when you put the numbers in place, it's just kind of amazing.
So the planet transiting in front of its host star creates a light dip. And what do we learn from that?
Well, we're back to those infrared spectrometers that are the specialty of the Webb telescope. It can analyze the light that has passed through that distant planet's atmosphere and see how the light has been filtered and the impact it has on the composition of that light. Tells us quite a bit about the atmosphere of that planet. And this is the light that was emitted from a sun light years from Earth, passing through the atmosphere of a planet that might, of course, just be a small fraction of the size of the host sun.
That Larson cartoon again. Okay, spectrometers help. What else is in play, Tim?
Well, they use the lingo secondary eclipse observations, so that the planet starts to move behind the host planet from our vantage point, that is, there's the opportunity to see how the infrared light from that planet changes or appears. And that information provides new insights into the temperature, composition, and heat distribution of the exoplanet's atmosphere. So I'm going to say up front that I'm not going to be able to, you know, really explain that, Steve, or understand all the science, but I do believe that what they're saying is, of course, the truth. And that the data that they're going to get from those transitions as the planet moves around and behind the host star will give us the information we're looking for. But, you know, Steve, as we always like to say, wait, there's more.
Well, there is, and there's always more in this kind of research. In this case, it's called direct imaging, and it's just what it sounds like. It's about the most difficult of techniques there is to detect clouds and dust covers just by directly imaging the planet itself.
Quite incredible. So those are the headline bits of research that we're expecting from the Webb telescope. But there's a lot more traditional research that they're going to be putting into play in terms of understanding our universe and the ability of the telescope to look back and find distant galaxies that will help tell us more about our own origins. It's going to retrace, if you will, some of the same work done by Hubble, but use infrared technology instead.
Ah, we're going to get back into some complex science, Tim, and we promise to try to keep that to a minimum this week. Let's see if we can do a Cole's Notes version, which is all I can manage, I say, at this point. There are quite a few reasons why the analysis of infrared emissions can help us understand the early universe. The universe has expanded since the Big Bang, causing the light emitted by distant objects to be red-shifted. Infrared observations are well suited for studying objects in the early universe because the redshift light falls in the infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah, that's really, you know, if we're going to be simplifying this to a level that makes sense for the ordinary person, non-scientist, that's
yeah,
it.
That's us.
that's us. And the infrared is just creating a much better visibility of the data that's being emitted from those distant galaxies. And that's really what we're talking about here.
That's right. And there are quasars, which will be a topic unto itself in a future episode. And those quasars are extremely bright and energetic sources powered by supermassive black holes. And infrared observations can detect quasars at high redshifts, enabling astronomers to study the early stages of galaxy and black hole formations. And with regard to examining interstellar dust and molecular gas clouds, Webb's infrared light can penetrate those clouds that obscure visible light observations. And by studying those emissions, astronomers will gain insights into the processes of stellar formation and the structures of galaxies.
So it really is coming down to the different kind of data that's received from infrared versus ultraviolet technology. So I really wanted to mention a bit more about how the Webb telescope is just perfectly placed to do and find out more about the cosmic microwave background, or CMB. The Webb is going to get information on that, about the background, which it's a remnant of the Big Bang itself, of the early universe, and the infrared observations that it can track, or it can, and the infrared observations that will be made by Webb can provide the information that we want to get to refine our understanding of what was the initial conditions like at that early moment.
Well done, Tim. And we already know that Webb is changing our knowledge of the earliest galactic formations and therefore how the universe as we presently know it came into existence. No doubt that is going to be a topic unto itself in a future episode.
Absolutely. But before we sign off, Steve, I wanted to give some love to the achievements of the Hubble Space Telescope. There were many, and I think there's two that are really worth mentioning. They call it deep field observations, and essentially that's what the Hubble Telescope was able to do, to find and study some of those most distant, oldest galaxies, giving us insights into the early times after the Big Bang. And as you mentioned, the Webb is going to be furthering that research. And the second area is dark energy. Now, Hubble played a huge role in our discovery of dark energy, and that was from studying supernovae, where it revealed that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, and that suggests the presence of some other kind of mysterious and repulsive force, which we now call dark energy. So, Steve, we've agreed to do an episode on dark energy, so we're not going to dig into that today. But, you know, if you had a list of the top three questions facing astrophysicists today, an understanding of dark energy is said to be questions 1, 2, and 3.
No doubt. Well, you know, Tim, I've really enjoyed the research that we've done on this particular episode. These two telescopes have given us an incredible insight into our place in the universe and how it works. And you mentioned off the top that the new Webb telescope cost $10 billion at the time of launch. And that sounds, if you will pardon the pun, like an astronomical number. Until you consider that the annual U.S. military budget is $735 billion. That's $735 billion this year, next year, the year after, and Webb cost $10 billion one shot. Personally speaking, I'd like to know more about how the universe began and how it works, especially repulsive gravity. And if we ever answer those questions, these two telescopes will have played a huge role, I have no doubt, in answering them.
Well, that's all the time we have today. And until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on...
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what's...